calumny. There was as good as no difference between the proportion of Jews and non-Jews in the German army relative to their numbers in the total population, and many served, some in the List regiment, with great distinction. There is no reason to presume, as has sometimes been the case, that this account of his anti-Jewish feelings in 1916 was a backwards projection of feelings that in reality only existed from 1918 to 19 onwards. Though, as we have noted, Hitler did not stand out for his anti-Semitism in the recollections of some of his former wartime comrades, two of them, Brandmeier and Westenkirchner, did refer to his negative comments about the Jews. And Hitler would have been voicing sentiments that were increasingly to be heard in the streets of Munich as anti-Jewish prejudice became more widespread and more ferocious in the second half of the war. Hitler wanted to get back to the front as soon as possible, and above all to rejoin his old regiment. He eventually returned to it on the 5th of March 1917 in its new position a few miles to the north of Vimy. In the summer, it was back to the same ground near Ypres that the regiment had fought over almost 3 years earlier to counter the major Flanders offensive launched by the British in mid-July 1917. Battered by the heavy fighting, the regiment was relieved at the beginning of August and transported to Alsace. At the end of September, Hitler took normal leave for the first time. He had no wish to go back to Munich, which had dispirited him so much, and went to Berlin instead, to stay with the parents of one of his comrades. His postcards to friends in the regiment spoke of how much he enjoyed his 18-day leave and how thrilled he was by Berlin and its museums. In mid-October, he returned to his regiment, which had just moved from Alsace to Champagne. Bitter fighting in April 1918 brought huge losses, and during the last 2 weeks of July, the regiment was involved in the Second Battle of the Marne. It was the last major German offensive of the war. By early August, when it collapsed in the face of a tenacious Allied counteroffensive, German losses in the previous 4 months of savage combat had amounted to around 800,000 men. The failure of the offensive marked the point where, with reserves depleted and morale plummeting, Germany's military leadership was compelled to recognize that the war was lost. On the 4th of August 1918, Hitler received the Iron Cross, first class, a rare achievement for a corporal, from the regimental commander, Major von Tubeuf. By a stroke of irony, he had a Jewish officer, Lieutenant Hugo Guttmann, to thank for the nomination. The story was later to be found in all schoolbooks that the Führer had received the EK-1 for single-handedly capturing 15 French soldiers. The truth, as usual, was somewhat more prosaic. From the available evidence, including the recommendation of the List regiment's deputy commander Freiherr von Golden on the 31st of July 1918, the award was made, as it was also to a fellow dispatch runner, for bravery shown in delivering an important dispatch following a breakdown in telephone communications from command headquarters to the front through heavy fire. Guttmann, from what he subsequently said, had promised both dispatch runners the EK-1 if they succeeded in delivering the message. But since the action was, though certainly courageous, not strikingly exceptional, it was only after several weeks of his belaboring the divisional commander that permission for the award was granted. By mid-August 1918, the List regiment had moved to Cambrai to help combat a British offensive near Bapaume, and a month later was back in action once more in the vicinity of Witscheid and Messines, where Hitler had received his EK-2 almost 4 years earlier. This time Hitler was away from the battlefields. In late August he had been sent for a week to Nuremberg for telephone communications training, and on the 10th of September he began his second period of 18 days leave, again in Berlin. Immediately on his return at the end of September, his unit was put under pressure from British assaults near Comines. Gas was now in extensive use in offensives, and protection against it was minimal and primitive. The List regiment, like others, suffered badly. On the night of the 13th to the 14th of October, Hitler himself fell victim to mustard gas on the heights south of Verwijk, part of the southern front near Ypres. He and several comrades, retreating from their dugout during a gas attack, were partially blinded by the gas and found their way to safety only by clinging on to each other and following a comrade who was slightly less badly afflicted. After initial treatment in Flanders, Hitler was transported on the 21st of October 1918 to the military hospital in Pasewalk near Stettin in Pomerania. The war was over for him, and little though he knew it, the Army High Command was already manoeuvring to extricate itself from blame for a war it accepted was lost and a peace which would soon have to be negotiated. It was in Pasewalk, recovering from his temporary blindness, that Hitler was to learn the shattering news of defeat and revolution, what he called the greatest villainy of the century. 4. In reality, of course, there had been no treachery, no stab in the back. This was a pure invention of the Reich, a legend the Nazis would use as a central element of their propaganda armory. Unrest at home was a consequence, not a cause, of military failure. Germany had been militarily defeated and was close to the end of its tether, though nothing had prepared people for capitulation. In fact, triumphalist propaganda was still coming from the High Command in late October 1918. The army was by then exhausted, and in the previous 4 months had suffered heavier losses than at any time during the war. In addition, illness took its toll. Around 1.75 million German soldiers had fallen victim to an influenza epidemic between March and July, and around 750,000 were wounded in the same period. It was little wonder that the medical service could not cope, that discipline sagged drastically, and that desertions and shirking, deliberately ducking duty, estimated at close on 1 million men in the last months of the war, rose dramatically. At home, the mood was one of mounting protest, embittered, angry, and increasingly rebellious. The revolution was not fabricated by Bolshevik sympathizers and unpatriotic troublemakers, but grew out of the profound disillusionment and rising unrest which had set in even as early as 1915 and from 1916 onwards had flowed into what finally became a torrent of disaffection. The society, which had seemingly entered the war in total patriotic unity, ended it completely riven and traumatized by the experience. Over 13 million Germans, just below a fifth of the population, served in the army during the war, over 10.5 million of them in the field. Around 2 million were killed, almost 5 million were wounded. A third of those killed had wives, almost all had families and friends. Such losses could not be experienced without leaving the most searing mark on mentalities. But experiences of the war and the impact of such experiences were in reality far from uniform. Certainly death, injury, and on the home front, hunger were omnipresent. Certainly, too, for those at the fighting front, the fatalism of existence in the trenches, the dangers and suffering, the anxieties and fears, the immensity of the losses, human and material, in the man-made wasteland of industrialized warfare, the interdependence for survival of the wholly male trench community, were inescapable impressions. But the experience that left Hitler as an arch-glorifier of war converted the expressionist playwright and writer Ernst Toller into a pacifist and left-wing revolutionary. Where for Hitler the defeat was betrayal, for Toller the betrayal was the war itself. "The war itself had turned me into an opponent of war," he wrote. "I felt that the land I loved had been betrayed and sold. It was for us to overthrow these betrayers." Experience of the war divided far more than it united. The front line against the shirkers in the rear, men against officers, the front against the home front. Above all, annexationists, imperialists, ardent believers in the war effort against those who detested it, disparaged it, and condemned it. The national community, which intellectuals saw forged in the trenches, was largely a myth. Even the trench camaraderie, the community of fate of a front generation, was in some measure a later literary mythologization. When the soldiers returned to the turmoil of a homeland in the throes of a revolution, it was not to form a unified front generation pitting the classless community of the trenches against a divided society changed out of all recognition, a militaristic, disillusioned mass ready-made to enter the Freikorps, and from there the SA. Certainly Hitler was later able to play upon such sentiments, but twice as many men entered the anti-war Reich Association of War Disabled, War Veterans, and War Dependents as joined the Freikorps. The soldiers took back with them divided experiences of the front that were to fuel the enormous divisions and tensions of post-war German society. Aside from worrying about loved ones at the front, those at home had to cope as best they could with massively worsening material conditions, leading often to extreme hardship. Women, drafted into industry, driving trams, running farms, increasingly found a main occupation in queuing for food. Most Germans, certainly those living in towns and cities, knew what hunger was during the war. Though there was not starvation, there was massive malnutrition. 750,000 died of it. As food prices soared, quality deteriorated, and supplies both diminished and were badly distributed, scarcities became acute, most notoriously in the turnip winter of 1916-17. By 1917, rations had fallen to a level of under 1,000 calories a day, less than half of what ought to be a minimum for a working person and of the average calorie intake before the war. Shortages were not confined to food. Most seriously, lack of coal meant people could not keep warm. Almost everyone other than the very rich was worse off during the war. In all walks of life, apart from those of the privileged, people were miserable, demoralized, and becoming by the day more intensely angry at a state which had taken them into war, interfered more and more in their daily lives, inflicted countless petty regulations on them, and had proved incapable of attaining victory. Food riots and strikes were only the most overt manifestation of a mood that in the second half of the war was ever more menacing for the authorities. Sharpened social tensions and heightened resentments were inevitable. Townspeople blamed farmers for holding back food. The rural population castigated those from the cities who descended like locusts on the countryside and ravaged it for scarce food supplies. Germans south of the Main, Bavarians naturally in the front line, attributed the war and all its ills to the Prussians, who in turn thought Bavarians to be living off the fat of the land while others starved, doing little for the war effort. Old middle-class resentments about unpatriotic workers after the interlude of the civil truce were drastically revivified in the later war years by strikes, demonstrations, and expressions of anti-war and increasingly anti-Kaiser feelings. If anything, the mood was worst of all among the lower middle class, craftsmen and white-collar workers, who in some parts of Germany at least were more heavily represented than blue-collar workers in the most openly revolutionary party, the USPD. Amid the social division, there were certain common targets of aggression. War profiteering, a theme on which Hitler was able to play so effectively in the Munich beer halls in 1920, rankled deeply. The big shots, dressed in fur-lined coats and top hats, fat cigars in their mouths, ferried around in limousines, appeared the very epitome of privilege, corruption, and exploitation, at a time that most of humanity was suffering grievously. Closely related was the bitter resentment of those running the black market. Petty officialdom, with its unremitting and intensified bureaucratic intervention into every sphere of everyday life, was a further target. But the fury did not confine itself to the interference and incompetence of petty bureaucrats. These were merely the face of a state whose authority was crumbling visibly, a state in terminal disarray and disintegration. Not least in the search for scapegoats, Jews increasingly became the focus of intensified hatred and aggression from the middle of the war onwards. The sentiments had all been heard before. What was new was the extent to which radical anti-Semitism was now being propagated, and the degree to which it was evidently falling on fertile ground. Like every other sector of society, Jews had been carried away by the spirit of 1914, at last, they thought, at one with their fellow Germans. By 1916, such presumed unity had been destroyed forever. A new wave of vicious, increasingly radical, folkish anti-Semitism was blatantly fostered by the annexationist lobby, and found more ready support than at any time before the war. Jews were now attacked as racially inferior immigrants flooding Germany, as war profiteers thriving on the nation's suffering, and as shirkers avoiding service at the front. That the numbers of Ostjuden entering Germany were insignificant, that 4 or 5 times more non-Jews than Jews were directors of armaments companies, and that the proportions of Jews and non-Jews serving at the front scarcely differed, could not, of course, prevent the spread of such a slander. Groundless allegations were kept alive by a statistical inquiry carried out in late 1916 into the number of Jews at the front and in the rear, followed by an investigation by the Reichstag into the numbers of Jews employed in the offices and agencies of the war economy. Though the results were not published, the allegations underlying the military survey were not repudiated, and Jews were thereafter not made officers, at least in the Prussian army. The backlash, articulated by classes pan-Germans and by the newly created massive Fatherland Party, of the pro-war lobby to the anti-annexationist peace resolution accepted in the Reichstag on the 19th of July 1917, linked the Jews to defeatism. There was a proliferation of anti-Semitic publications, and Klass could report to the pan-German leadership in October 1917 that anti-Semitism had already reached enormous proportions, and that the struggle for survival was now beginning for the Jews. Events in Russia in 1917 further stirred the pot of simmering hatred, adding the vital ingredient, to become thereafter the keystone of anti-Semitic agitation, of the Jews portrayed as running secret international organizations directed at fomenting world revolution. As it was realized that the war was lost, anti-Semitic hysteria, whipped up by the pan-Germanists, reached fever pitch. Klass used the notorious words of Heinrich von Kleist aimed at the French in 1813, when a Jewish committee, with the purpose of exploiting the situation to sound the clarion call against Judaism and to use the Jews as lightning rods for all injustices, was set up by the pan-Germans in September 1918. Kill them! The world court is not asking you for your reasons. 5. The atmosphere of disintegration and collapsing morale, the climate of political and ideological radicalization in the last 2 war years could not but make the deepest impression on a Hitler who had welcomed the war so rapturously, had supported German aims so fanatically, and had from the outset condemned all defeatist suggestions so vehemently. He was repelled by many attitudes he encountered at the front. But as we have seen, it was during the 3 periods, amounting in total to over 3 months, that he spent in Germany either on leave or recovering from injury in the last 2 war years, that he experienced a level of disaffection at the running of the war which was new and deeply appalling to him. He had been shocked at the atmosphere in Berlin, and even more so Munich in 1916. As the war dragged on, he became incensed by the talk of revolution and incandescent at news of the munitions strike in favor of early peace without annexations, which had spread briefly at the end of January 1918 from Berlin to other major industrial cities, though with little actual effect on munitions supplies. Brandmeier recalled Hitler's enraged comments that if he had been war minister, the strike leaders would have been stood against a wall within 24 hours. According to Brandmeier, he held Friedrich Ebert responsible. It is, of course, possible that Brandmeier was simply paraphrasing Hitler's own account in Mein Kampf. However, there seems no obvious reason to disbelieve Hitler when he wrote that he was already associating the unrest at home with the social democratic leadership who, in his view, were ripe for hanging. As signs of demoralization and disintegration intensified at the front, as well as within Germany, the soldiers became more politicized. Hitler commented on the symptoms of disintegration in August and September 1918, and that the troops now engaged in political arguments as the poison from the homeland took effect. Brandmeier's remark that Hitler took a keen interest in developments within Germany and involved himself in such discussions sounds plausible. The last 2 years of the war, between his convalescence in Bielitz in October 1916 and his hospitalization in Pasewalk in October 1918, can probably be seen as a vital staging post in Hitler's ideological development. The prejudices and phobias carried over from the Vienna years were now plainly evident in his embittered rage about the collapse of the war effort, a cause to which, for the first time in his life, he had totally bound himself, the summation of all that he had believed in. But they had not yet been fully rationalized into the component parts of a political ideology. That would only emerge fully during Hitler's own political training in the Reichswehr in the course of 1919. What part the hospitalization in Pasewalk played in the shaping of Hitler's ideology, what significance it had for the shaping of the future party leader and dictator, has been much disputed and in truth is not easy to evaluate. In Hitler's own account, it has a pivotal place. Recovering from his temporary blindness, but unable to read newspapers, so he wrote, Hitler heard rumors of pending revolution, but did not fully comprehend them. The arrival of some mutineering sailors was the first tangible sign of serious disturbance, but Hitler and fellow patients from Bavaria presumed the unrest would be crushed within a few days. However, it became clear, the most terrible certainty of my life, that a general revolution had taken place. On the 10th of November, a pastor addressed the patients in sorrowful terms about the end of the monarchy and informed them that Germany was now a republic, that the war was lost, and that Germans had to place themselves at the mercy of the victors whose magnanimity could be expected. At this, Hitler wrote, I could stand it no longer. It became impossible for me to sit still 1 minute more. Again, everything went black before my eyes. I tottered and groped my way back to the dormitory, threw myself on my bunk, and dug my burning head into my blanket and pillow. Since the day when I had stood at my mother's grave, I had not wept, but now I could not help it. And so it had all been in vain. Did all this happen only so that a gang of wretched criminals could lay hands on the fatherland? The more I tried to achieve clarity on the monstrous event in this hour, the more the shame of indignation and disgrace burned my brow. What was all the pain in my eyes compared to this misery? There followed terrible days and even worse nights. I knew that all was lost. In these nights, hatred grew in me, hatred for those responsible for this deed. In the days that followed, my own fate became known to me. I could not help but laugh at the thought of my own future, which only a short time before had given me such bitter concern. He drew, according to his own account, the conclusion that there is no making pacts with Jews. There can only be the hard either-or. And he made the decision that changed his life. I, for my part, decided to go into politics. Hitler referred to his Pasewalk experience on a number of occasions in the early 1920s. There were even embellishments to the story which was to appear in Mein Kampf. He told a variety of associates that as he lay blinded in Pasewalk, he received a type of vision, message, or inspiration to liberate the German people and make Germany great again. This highly unlikely, purported quasi-religious experience was part of the mystification of his own person, which Hitler encouraged as a key component of the Führer myth that was already embryonically present among many of his followers in the 2 years leading up to the putsch attempt. At his subsequent trial, Hitler played down the vision story, which would have invited ridicule, and stated only that hearing in Pasewalk of the revolution had made him resolve to enter politics. A year and a half earlier, in December 1922, he had offered another gloss on his reactions in Pasewalk. By his own account, he thought over all his experiences at the front and in the rear while hospitalized for a severe injury, and came to the conclusion that Marxism and Jewry are the German people's worst enemies. From personal experience, it has become a certainty for him that wherever misfortune or harm befalls the German nation, a Jew is the culprit behind it. Some have been tempted to read into Hitler's colourful accounts of his Pasewalk experience an hallucination, which holds the key to his manic ideological obsessions, his mission to save Germany, and his rapport with the German people themselves traumatized by defeat and national humiliation. Still recovering from being blinded by mustard gas poisoning, the traumatic shock of hearing of defeat and revolution, it has been suggested, was subliminally associated in Hitler's mind with the ideoform poisoning of his mother at the hands of the Jewish Dr. Bloch in 1907, accounting for the sudden dominance of a pathological anti-Semitism that had not been present before, and for the ever-present drive to poison the Jews through gassing them, since he saw them as responsible for his mother's death. Apart from seemingly reducing the complex developments that were to lead to the mass murder of the Jews during the Second World War to the alleged trauma of a single person in 1918, the interpretation remains speculative and lacks persuasion. The balance of probabilities suggests a less dramatic process of ideological development and political awareness. Whatever Hitler's state of shock and anxiety over his temporary and partial blinding, from which he was beginning to recover, it is unlikely that a second, this time hysterical or hallucinatory blinding, took place in Pasewalk. The effects of mustard gas do not damage the eye itself and produce not actual blindness, but such a severe conjunctivitis and swelling of the eyelids that sight is for a time greatly impaired. A recurrence of the secondary blindness is easily caused by rubbing of the eyes, which, if Hitler was, as he says, brought to tears by news of the revolution, may well have been what occurred. What does seem certain, even so, is that Hitler was more than just deeply outraged by the news of the revolution, that he felt it to be an absolute and unpardonable betrayal of all that he believed in, and, in pain, discomfort and bitterness, looked for the culprits who would provide him with an explanation of how his world had collapsed. There is no need to doubt that for Hitler, these intensely disturbing few days did amount to no less than a traumatic experience. From the following year onwards, his entire political activity was driven by the trauma of 1918, aimed at expunging the defeat and revolution which had betrayed all that he had believed in, and eliminating those he held responsible. But if there is any strength in the suggestion we have put forward that Hitler acquired his deep-seated prejudices, including his anti-Semitism in Vienna, and had them revitalized during the last two war years, if without rationalizing them into a composite ideology, then there is no need to mystify the Pasewalk experience through seeing it as a sudden dramatic conversion to paranoid anti-Semitism. Rather, Pasewalk might be viewed as the time when, as Hitler lay tormented and seeking an explanation of how his world had been shattered, his own rationalization started to fall into place. Devastated by the events unfolding in Munich, Berlin, and other cities, he must have read into them outright confirmation of the views he had always held from the Vienna days on Jews and social democrats, on Marxism and internationalism, on pacifism and democracy. Even so, it was still only the beginning of the rationalization. The full fusion of his anti-Semitism and anti-Marxism was yet to come. There is no authentic evidence that Hitler, up to and including this point, had said a word about Bolshevism. Nor would he do so, even in his early public speeches in Munich before 1920. The connection of Bolshevism with his internal hate figures, its incorporation into and adoption of a central place in his worldview, came only during his time in the Reichswehr in the summer of 1919. And later still came the preoccupation with living space, only emerging into a dominant theme at the time that he dictated Mein Kampf in 1924. Pasewalk was a crucial step on the way to Hitler's rationalization of his prejudices, but even more important, in all probability, was the time he spent in the Reichswehr in 1919. The last implausible point of Hitler's Pasewalk story is that he resolved, there and then, to enter politics. In none of his speeches before the putsch in November 1923 did Hitler say a word about deciding in autumn 1918 to enter politics. In fact, Hitler was in no position in Pasewalk to decide to enter politics or anything else. The end of the war meant that, like most other soldiers, he faced demobilization. The army had been his home for 4 years, but now, once more, his future was uncertain. When he left Pasewalk on the 19th of November 1918, 8 days after the armistice, to return via Berlin to Munich, he had savings totaling only 15 marks, 30 pfennig, in his Munich account. No career awaited him, nor did he make any effort to enter politics. Indeed, it is not easy to see how he could have done so. Neither family nor connections were available to gain him some minor patronage in a political party. A decision to enter politics, should Hitler have made one in Pasewalk, would have been empty of meaning. Only staying in the army offered him the hope of avoiding the evil day when he would once more have to face up to the fact that 4 turbulent years on, he was no nearer his chosen career as an architect than he had been in 1914, and was without any prospects whatsoever. The future looked bleak. A return to the lonely existence of the pre-war small-time painter had no appeal. But little else beckoned. The army gave him his chance. He was able to stave off demobilization longer than almost all his former comrades, and to keep on the payroll until the 31st of March 1920. It was in the army in 1919 that his ideology finally took shape. Above all, the army, in the extraordinary circumstances of 1919, turned Hitler into a propagandist, the most talented demagogue of his day. Not a deliberate choice, but making the most of the conditions in which he found himself provided Hitler with his entry into politics. Opportunism and a good slice of luck were more instrumental than strength of will. 4. Discovering a talent. I was offered an opportunity of speaking before a larger audience, and the thing that I had always presumed from pure feeling without knowing it was now corroborated. I could speak. Hitler in Mein Kampf. Herr Hitler especially is, I might say, a born popular speaker, who, through his fanaticism and his populist style in a meeting, absolutely compels his audience to take note and share his views. One of the soldiers addressed by Hitler at Lechfeld in August 1919. Goodness, he's got a gob. We could use him. Anton Drexler, leader of the DAP, hearing Hitler speak for the first time in September 1919. On the 21st of November 1918, 2 days after leaving hospital in Pasewalk, Hitler was back in Munich. Approaching 30 years of age, without education, career, or prospects, his only plans were to stay in the army, which had been his home and had provided for him since 1914, as long as possible. He came back to a Munich he scarcely recognized. The barracks to which he returned were run by soldiers' councils. The revolutionary Bavarian government, in the shape of a provisional national council, was in the hands of the Social Democrats and the more radical independent Social Democrats. The minister-president, Kurt Eisner, was a radical, and he was a Jew. By spring, Eisner was to be assassinated, Bavarian politics to come close to chaos, and Munich, for a month in April, to be ruled by Soviet-style councils, for the last 2 weeks of April, by communists looking directly to Moscow for their model. The bloody repression accompanying the liberation of Munich by Reichswehr troops and Freikorps, volunteer freebooter formations, was to lead to Hitler's first involvement in counter-revolutionary activity. In turn, this was to mark the beginning of the process which would see him employed by the army as an informant, talent spotted as a born popular speaker by his superior officer in the Reichswehr, and entering politics, still in army service, as a populist agitator in the tiny German Workers' Party. One of the most remarkable aspects of the biographical parts of Mein Kampf is how quickly Hitler passed over his own experience of the traumatic revolutionary period in Bavaria. After all, he witnessed, for the most part at close quarters, the turmoil which so deeply scarred his psyche. He was based in Munich, at the epicenter of events for the whole period that saw the descent into political chaos following the assassination of Eisner and culminated in the violent end of the Council's Republic. Yet his entire treatment of the months between the November Revolution and the suppression of the Räterepublik covers a mere page of his otherwise expansive book. Finding the soldiers' councils in charge of his regiment so repelled him, he wrote, that he decided to leave again as soon as possible. He was sent after volunteering for service, is the clear implication, with his closest wartime comrade, Ernst Schmidt, whose name he misspells as Schmiedt, S-C-H-M-I-E-D-T, to Traunstein in the east of Bavaria, not far from the Austrian border, where he remained until the camp, which held prisoners of war, was disbanded, returning to Munich in March 1919. During the Rote Republik, the passing rule of the Jews, as he dubbed it, Hitler claimed he pondered what could be done, but repeatedly realized that since he was nameless, he did not possess the least basis for any useful action. In other words, he did nothing. Before, that is, allegedly acting in some way, though he does not describe it, and the whole story has the air of a fabrication that aroused the disapproval of the Central Council. Accordingly, in his account, he was to have been arrested on the 27th of April, but drove away with a loaded rifle the three men who had come to take him into custody. Finally, he adds that a few days after the liberation of Munich, he was summoned to report to the commission examining the revolutionary occurrences within his regiment, his first, more or less, purely political activity. The gulf between the momentous nature of the events taking place before his eyes and this brief and laconic account came not unnaturally to fuel speculation that Hitler was trying to obfuscate his own actions and conceal a role which might prove embarrassing to the later nationalist hero. It does seem likely that this was indeed his aim, and to a considerable extent he succeeded in it. What Hitler did, how he reacted to the drama unfolding around him in Munich in the first half of 1919, remains for the most part a dark spot in his personal history. Even so, the evidence, patchy in the extreme though it is, reveals one or two surprises. 1. The German Revolution, which had been triggered by the mutinies at Wilhelmshaven and Kiel at the end of October and beginning of November, and rapidly spread to most cities and large towns, reaching the national capital on the 9th of November, was a messy, largely spontaneous and uncoordinated affair. It arose not, as the right claimed, from the treacherous machinations of hardcore left-wing revolutionaries, but, as we have already noted, out of massive disaffection and mounting popular protest, demanding an end to the war, an end to the hunger and misery at home, and the removal of a monarchy capable of bringing about neither. Following the German request on the 3rd of October for an armistice, which had shocked a German population totally unprepared for defeat, the movement for peace had gathered pace like a bushfire. The American President Woodrow Wilson had indicated on the 23rd of October, in his third note replying to the German request, that military rulers and autocratic monarchs posed an obstacle to peace negotiations. It was only at this stage that revolutionary groups and organizations, until then weak and not numerous, found themselves at the head of a groundswell of popular demand for radical change. Soldiers' and workers' councils sprang into existence. Monarchies tumbled. The House of Wittelsbach, rulers of Bavaria for over seven centuries, was the first German monarchy to fall on the 7th of November. The Kaiser himself abdicated on the 9th. The red flag fluttered over the palace in Berlin where the imperial standard had flown. But ending the old system was easier than erecting a new one. Almost all the representatives of the mobilized masses wanted democratization. But opinion varied on what that meant in practice and how to achieve it. Improvisation, rather than planning, was the hallmark of the council's movement. The great majority of councils favored a move to parliamentary democracy, but the minority, wanting more radical solutions by building on and extending the power of the councils, gradually became more extreme in their demands, as the majority social democrats under Friedrich Ebert showed themselves too fearful of what was coming out of the Pandora's box of potential social change that had been opened, too timid to trust even their own mass support, and too willing to side with the forces of the old order rather than risk more democracy. Nothing was done to meet demands for the socialization of industries, especially mining, the democratization of the army, and drastic reform of the civil service. Instead, the forces of reaction, for a short time in disarray, were allowed to regroup. The splits within the revolutionary movement that had been there from the outset widened alarmingly. In Berlin, the independents left the government, the Council of People's Representatives, at the end of December. The move to the right had its most fateful moment in the deployment by the SPD government of troops and counter-revolutionary Freikorps units to suppress the small, ill-organized, and mismanaged so-called Spartacus Rising, carried out by left radicals, mainly supporters of the newly formed KPD in Berlin in early January 1919. The murder of the Spartacist leaders Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg on the 15th of January was the symbolic sealing of the disastrous rift within the working-class movement that, throughout the Weimar Republic, prevented any united front being formed against the growing threat of National Socialism. The revolution in Bavaria had preceded that in the Reich itself. It took place in circumstances and developed in ways that were to leave a profound mark on Hitler and to fit more than the events in Berlin into what became the Nazi caricature of the 1918 revolution. It was more radical, with the leadership in the hands of the independents. It degenerated into near anarchy, then into a short-lived attempt to create a communist-run Soviet-style system. This in turn led to a few days, though a few days which seared the consciousness of Bavarians for many years to come, that amounted to a mini-civil war ending in bloodshed and brutality. And a number of the revolutionary leaders happened to be Jewish, some of them East European Jews with Bolshevik sympathies and connections. Moreover, the leader of the Bavarian Revolution, the Jewish journalist and left-wing socialist Kurt Eisner, a prominent peace campaigner in the USPD since the split with the majority Social Democrats in 1917, together with some of his USPD colleagues, had unquestionably tried to stir up industrial unrest during the January strike in 1918 and had been arrested for his actions. That was to fit nicely into the Reich's stab-in-the-back legend. The same was true of Eisner's subsequent publication of official Bavarian documents revealing Germany's complicity in Austria's ultimatum to Serbia in July 1914, which fed right-wing allegations of treason against him and his entourage even after the minister-president's assassination in February 1919. When, with a cry of off to the barracks, workers, peasants, soldiers and sailors attending a huge peace demonstration on Munich's Theresienwiese on the 7th of November 1918, addressed by Eisner, had headed for the city's main garrison area, they had met with no resistance from the troops. There was relatively little genuine revolutionary fervour in the barracks, but nevertheless as good as no opposition to the revolution and no support left for the monarchy. War weariness was the main determinant of the mood. These people wanted neither continued war nor revolutionary tribunals and burning stately homes, wrote one eyewitness long after the events. They wanted to get home to their farms and workshops. Without support from the army, the monarchy was finished. The ailing King Ludwig III and his family fled that night. Hitler, over two decades later, was to remark that at least he had to thank the Social Democrats for ridding him of these courtly interests. The provisional government that was soon constituted under Eisner's leadership was from the outset a highly unstable coalition, mainly composed of the radical but largely idealistic USPD and the moderate SPD, which had not even wanted a revolution. Moreover, it stood no chance of mastering the daunting social and economic problems it faced. Without support from the countryside, in a largely rural province, the provisioning problems alone could not be tackled. But the price of any such support was the abandonment of radical land reform plans. Conditions continued to worsen. The political turmoil mounted. Elections in January reduced the USPD to a rump. Rapidly and predictably, the radicals had lost support, above all, in the Bavarian countryside, massively disaffected, but remaining at the same time innately and overwhelmingly conservative. The assassination of Eisner by a young aristocratic former officer, currently a student at Munich University, Graf Anton von Arcovalli on the 21st of February 1919, provided then the signal for a deterioration into chaos and near anarchy. With Red Guards tramping the corridors and rooms of the Wittelsbach Palace, where once maids-in-waiting and powdered lackeys had fawned attendance on their royal masters, a meeting in the one-time bedroom of the Queen of Bavaria, dominated by members of the USPD and anarchists, proclaimed a council's republic in Bavaria. Majority socialists and communists, the latter dubbing it a pseudo-council's republic, Scheinräter Republik, refused to participate. An attempt to unseat it by using troops loyal to the elected government, now exiled in Bamberg, failed on the 13th of April. But the initial failure of the counter-revolution simply strengthened the resolve of the revolutionary hotheads and ushered in the last phase of the Bavarian Revolution, the full communist takeover in the second, or real, Räte Republik, an attempt to introduce a Soviet-style system in Bavaria. Today, Bavaria has finally erected the dictatorship of the proletariat, ran the proclamation of the new executive council under the direction of the communist Eugen Levine, a veteran of the 1905 Russian Revolution. It lasted little more than a fortnight, but it ended in violence, bloodshed, and deep recrimination, imposing a baleful legacy on the political climate of Bavaria. In conditions of a proclaimed 10-day general strike, a Red Army of around 20,000 workers and soldiers, drawn mainly from Munich's big factories and army garrison, was gathered under the command of the 23-year-old sailor and veteran of the Kiel Mutiny, Rudolf Egelhofer. But it was without hope against the Prussian and Württemberg troops, combined with Bavarian Freikorps units that now massed around Munich. The day after Egelhofer, on the 29th of April, had proclaimed the dictatorship of the Red Army, 8, including a woman of the Red Army's prisoners, among them several from the Volkisch Thule Gesellschaft held as hostages in the Luitpold Gymnasium, together with 2 captured soldiers from the government troops, were badly maltreated, then shot by their captors. The fateful order for the shooting had been given as retaliation for atrocities committed by the encroaching White Guard on the outskirts of Munich. News of the shooting of the hostages spread like wildfire, horrified the city, and incited the counter-revolutionary army to speed up its assault on Munich and to undertake drastic and savage reprisals. The street fighting in the city centre of Munich and in some working-class districts was bloody. Flamethrowers, heavy artillery, armoured vehicles, even aircraft were deployed in a short but merciless civil war. The victims of the White Guard included 53 Russian prisoners of war who had nothing whatsoever to do with the Räte Republik, but were driven into a quarry and summarily dispatched. A group of first aiders mowed down as supposed revolutionaries, 12 civilian SPD supporters in the working-class district of Perlach who had been denounced by political enemies, and 21 members of the Catholic St. Joseph's Association mistaken for Spartacists. For several days, terror ruled Munich's streets. All involved in the socialist experiment had to fear for their lives. When Munich was finally liberated on the 3rd of May, the death toll numbered at least 606 persons, 335 of them civilians. Of the leaders of the Räte Republik, only the Russian-born communist Max Levine escaped the clutches of the right-wing backlash. Egelhofer and the Jewish anarchist and writer Gustav Landauer were murdered by Freikorps troops. Levine was executed for high treason amid a storm of protest and a one-day general strike in Berlin. The anarchist Jewish writer Erich Mühsam was sentenced to 15 years, Ernst Toller, another Jewish writer, to 5 years. In all, the draconian sentences meted out totaled some 6,000 years. 65 of those indicted were sentenced to hard labor, 1,737 to periods of imprisonment, and 407 to lighter internment. It would be hard to exaggerate the impact on political consciousness in Bavaria of the events between November 1918 and May 1919, and quite especially of the Räte Republik. At its very mildest, it was experienced in Munich itself as a time of curtailed freedom, severe food shortages, press censorship, general strike, sequestration of foodstuffs, coal, and items of clothing, and general disorder and chaos. But of more lasting significance, it went down in popular memory as a rule of horror, Schreckensherrschaft, imposed by foreign elements in the service of Soviet communism. In reality, the revolutionaries had achieved nothing beyond gaining some genuine support from Munich's soldiers and workers. Neither the threat to confiscate private property nor the creation of a new political and social order had any prospect of implementation. The shooting of the hostages in the Luitpold Gymnasium was deplorable and horrified the Munich bourgeoisie. But it paled alongside the atrocities perpetrated by the liberating troops, which were regarded with relative equanimity as restoring order. However, as so often, images were more telling than reality, and the image, constructed and massively shored up by rightist propaganda throughout the Reich as well as in Bavaria itself, was that of alien, Bolshevik and Jewish forces taking over the state, threatening institutions, traditions, order, and property, presiding over chaos and mayhem, perpetrating terrible acts of violence, and causing anarchy of advantage only to Germany's enemies. Even more moderate press organs painted much the same picture. The mainstream newspaper of Munich's middle class, the Münchner Neueste Nachrichten, spoke of the aims and methods of Russian Bolshevism, Russian emissaries, Bolshevik agents, the practice of Asiatic Bolshevism, and foreign agitators. It placed the blame for the criminal atrocities and the bestial slaughter of innocent hostages squarely on the communist leaders. Any leniency shown towards such criminals would be a sin against the laws of humanity and justice, it was stated. In contrast, the troops who had liberated Munich from the Red Terror had, it was claimed, in strict discipline, restored the spirit of order. A mere 18 months after the Russian Revolution, and fueled by reports of the terrible civil war taking place in Russia, in which the Bolsheviks eventually defeated their counter-revolutionary enemies, but only after immense mortalities and unspeakable savagery on both sides, it is not hard to recognize how penetrating and pervasive the neurotic fear of Bolshevism was in a rural province of deeply ingrained conservatism and in politically polarized towns and cities. The real gainers from the disastrous weeks of the Rete Republik were the radical right, which had been given the fuel to stoke the fear and hatred of Bolshevism among the Bavarian peasantry and middle classes. Not least, extreme counter-revolutionary violence had come to be accepted as a legitimate response to the perceived Bolshevik threat and now became a regular feature of the political scene. Its flirt with left-wing socialism over, Bavaria turned in the following years into a bastion of the conservative right and a magnet for right-wing extremists throughout Germany. Though their political tendencies differed sharply, white-blue Bavarian separatists, black-white-red nationalists, and folkish extremists found common cause in their hatred of the Bolshevik and broader Marxist left. And the Bavarian Reichswehr became a stronghold of reactionary, anti-republican, counter-revolutionary forces, which were strengthened still further after March 1920, when the leaders of the failed right-wing KAP Putsch and their paramilitary organizations found a haven awaiting them in Bavaria. These were the conditions in which the making of Adolf Hitler could take place. Not least, as already indicated, the history of the Bavarian Revolution was almost tailor-made for Nazi propaganda. Not just the legend of the stab in the back, but the notion of an international Jewish conspiracy could be made to sound plausible in the light of the Munich Rete Republik. Though right-wing extremism had no stronger traditions in Bavaria than elsewhere up to this point, the new climate provided it with unique opportunities and the favor of a sympathetic establishment. Many of Hitler's early followers were deeply influenced by the experience of the turbulent months of post-revolutionary Bavaria. For Hitler himself, the significance of the period of revolution and Rete Republik in Munich can hardly be overrated. It has been said that Hitler did not decide to become a politician. Rather, through the revolution and the rule of the councils, politics came to him, into the barracks. It is time to explore the truth of that assertion. 2. On his return to Munich on the 21st of November 1918, Hitler had been assigned to the 7th Company of the 1st Reserve Battalion of the 2nd Infantry Regiment, where, a few days later, he met up again with several wartime comrades. A fortnight later, he and one of these comrades, Ernst Schmidt, were among the 15 men from his company, and 140 men in all, assigned to guard duties at the Traunstein prisoner of war camp. Probably, as Schmidt later recounted, Hitler suggested they let their names go forward when volunteers were called for to make up the deputation. Hitler, remarked Schmidt, did not have much to say about the revolution, but it was plain enough to see how bitter he felt. Both, according to Schmidt, were repelled by the changed conditions in the Munich barracks, now in the hands of the soldiers' councils, where old standards of authority, discipline, and morale had collapsed. If that was indeed the reason for volunteering, Hitler and Schmidt could have found no improvement on reaching Traunstein. The camp, meant to contain 1,000 prisoners but much overcrowded, was also run by the soldiers' councils, which Hitler allegedly so detested. Discipline was poor, and the guards, according to one source, included some of the worst elements among the troops, who, like Hitler, saw the army as a means of maintaining a carefree existence at the expense of the state. Hitler and Schmidt had an easy time of things, mainly on gate duty at Traunstein. They were there in all for almost 2 months, during which time the prisoners of war, mainly Russians, were transported elsewhere. By the beginning of February, the camp was completely cleared and disbanded. Probably in late January, as Schmidt hinted, Hitler returned to Munich. He certainly returned no later than mid-February, not March, as he himself stated, since on the 12th of February, his own military record shows that he was assigned to the 2nd Demobilization Company to await discharge. In general, as we have noted, the demobilization of the German army was carried out remarkably swiftly and efficiently. All Hitler's close wartime comrades, including Ernst Schmidt, were discharged well before he was. But Hitler himself was able to avoid discharge until March 1920, owed everything to his increasing involvement from the late spring of 1919 in political work for the Reichswehr, out of which his entry into politics was to emerge. Meanwhile, he was keen to take whatever opportunity presented itself to stay in the army as long as possible. For just over 2 weeks, beginning on the 20th of February, he was assigned to guard duty at the Hauptbahnhof, where a unit of his company was responsible for maintaining order, particularly among the many soldiers travelling to and from Munich. During this period, the guard command at the station was the subject of an investigatory commission examining numerous instances of maltreatment of persons arrested. Whether Hitler was involved is not known, though he cannot fail to have been a witness to the violence and brutality. Beyond guard duties, Hitler, Schmidt, and the others in their demobilization company had as good as nothing to do. They were able to earn 3 marks a day testing old gas masks, which gave them enough money for the occasional visit to the opera. Normal earnings appear to have been about 40 marks a month, with food and accommodation provided, certainly enough to keep body and soul together. The future outside the army looked distinctively less rosy. As we have noted, Hitler spoke of his involvement in the investigatory commission following the suppression of the Rote Republik as his first political activity. Evidence recently come to light of Hitler's actions during the revolutionary era does not accord with this assertion. It also helps to suggest why Hitler was so reticent about his behavior during the months that the November criminals, as he later repeatedly called them, ruled Munich. A routine order of the demobilization battalion on the 3rd of April 1919 referred to Hitler by name as the representative Vertrauensmann of his company. The strong likelihood is, in fact, that he had held this position since the 15th of February. The duties of the representatives, Vertrauensleute, included cooperation with the propaganda department of the socialist government in order to convey educational material to the troops. Hitler's first political duties took place, therefore, in the service of the revolutionary regime run by the SPD and USPD. It is little wonder that he later wished to say little of his actions at this time. In fact, he would have had to explain away the even more embarrassing fact of his continued involvement at the very height of Munich's Red Dictatorship. On the 14th of April, the day after the Communist Räterepublik had been proclaimed,